Grace. 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 Grace.
All right. The first part of our lesson tonight should trigger a question in your mind. I will see if it does, and if not, I will trigger it for you and then answer the question. We're starting in 2 Samuel chapter 9. 2 Samuel chapter 9, starting in verse 1. And the long name there for Jonathan's son is Mephibosheth. So this section here is called David's Kindness to Mephibosheth. Starting in verse 1, 2 Samuel chapter 9, verse 1. Now David said, "Is there still anyone who is left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" And there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba. So when they had called him to David, the king said to him, "Are you Ziba?" He said, "At your service." Then the king said, "Is there not still someone of the house of Saul to whom I may show the kindness of God?" And Ziba said to the king, "There is still a son of Jonathan who is lame in his feet." So the king said to him, "Where is he?" And Ziba said to the king, "Indeed, he is in the house of Maker, the son of Amiel, in Lo Debar." Then King David sent and brought him out of the house of Maker, son of Amiel, from Lo Debar. Now when Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, had come to David, he fell on his face and prostrated himself. Then David said, "Mephibosheth?" And he said, "Here is your servant." So David said to him, "Do not fear, for I will surely show you kindness for Jonathan, your father's sake, and will restore to you all the land of Saul, your grandfather, and you shall eat the bread at my table continually." Then he bowed himself and said, "What is your servant that you should look upon such a dead dog as I?" And the king said to Ziba, "Saul's servants," then the king called Ziba, Saul's servant, and said to him, "I have given to your master's son all that belonged to Saul and to all his house. You therefore and your sons and your servants shall work the land for him, and you shall bring in the harvest that your master's son may have food to eat. But Mephibosheth, your master's son, shall eat bread at my table always." Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Then Ziba said to the king, "According to all that my lord the king has commanded a servant, so will your servant do." "As for Mephibosheth," said the king, "he shall eat at my table like one of the king's sons." Mephibosheth had a son, a young son, whose name was Micah. And all that dwelt in the house of Ziba were the servants of Mephibosheth. So Mephibosheth dwelt in Jerusalem, for he ate continually at the king's table, and he was lame in both of his feet. Now, can anybody tell me what question I was thinking this should have triggered in your mind, based on what we've covered in 2 Samuel up to this point?
Yes. Anything to do with the land that's being restored?
No, it does not. Mm-mm. Good question, though. For time's sake, I'll just go ahead and tell you. Way back when we were reading, it's not really all that way back because it's only in 2 Samuel. We haven't been there that long. But when we were reading about King David retaking Jerusalem from the Jebusites, we heard David say that he hated the lame. And yet here he is honoring a lame man. And so, you know, I would think that might, you know, raise a question. I was kind of surprised at the time when we read it back in 2 Samuel 5 that no one even asked about it when we covered it. But I held my peace because I knew that this passage we're reading tonight was coming up, and I thought I'd cover it then. So I'll go ahead and read the passage I'm talking about. It's in 2 Samuel chapter 5, verses 5 through 8. It says, "In Hebron he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months. In Jerusalem he reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah. The king and his men marched to Jerusalem against the Jebusites who inhabited the land. The Jebusites had said to David, "You will never get in here. Even the blind and the lame could repel you," thinking that David could never get in. Yet David did, in fact, capture the stronghold of Zion, the city of David. He said that day, whoever attacks the Jebusites must go through the water shaft to reach the lame and the blind who are despised by David. For this reason, it is said, the lame and the blind will never enter the house. So there were strong words, and they were against lame people and blind people. And so, you know, I thought when we first read it, surely someone would say, that doesn't sound very David-like. Why would David hate lame people? Well, as for the reason David said this, there are actually three speculations, only one of which, in my opinion, hold any water. But I'll tell you all three of them. The first one was he said it in scorn against the chiding of the Jebusites, because the Jebusites had said, you know what, even the lame or the blind of our city could repel you and keep you out of our city. So he might have said it in scorn and chiding against the Jebusites' words. The second one is that it was said because a lame person could not have entered the city to help reclaim it, because it was required to go through a breach in the water shaft. But I really don't think that's the case, because David would have never, as far we know of his character, would never have despised a person because of that. The third one that I think is really the possibility, it was said that, said as a play on words against the idol gods of the Jebusites, who were made of wood and stone and metal, since they were without life and therefore were blind and lame. And so he was essentially taking their words as a spin against them. They'd said, well, you know, even the blind and the lame could keep you out of our city because it's so well fortified. And his statement to them was against their blind and lame idols and how they could never protect them. Those idols could never protect them from the God of Israel. So it's something that gets lost in translation. You don't really pick up on it in the reading. But one thing that we know that for sure that we don't have a basis for truly believing is that David hated the lame. It's out of character for David. Now we know that even if David did, for some unforeseen reason, illogical reason, hate lame people, he still would have acted as he did for Mephibosheth, because it really wasn't about Mephibosheth. He was doing this to honor the friendship he had with Jonathan, which is said two times in the passage we just got done reading. This was all about Jonathan. And this is perhaps one of two lessons that I really want to draw out tonight that, again, makes David a man after God's own heart, number one, and number two, makes David a type of Christ or a type of an image of the Father. Because David, long after the death of his friend, continues to honor his friend as though his friend were still alive. It's a point of honoring and integrity in his heart. And it's something that we also see is a way of God. God had promised David, we just saw it a week or so ago, that, how David wanted to build a house for God. And God said, no, you're not going to build a house for me. We didn't learn why. We find out much later that it's because David was a man of blood and had killed so many people that God's like, you know what? You know, you've been a man of war and a man of blood. And because blood is on your hands, even though it was to do things I commissioned you to do, you're not going to build my house. Your son will. At the same time, David had this a desire to do this. And what God did in reply to David's heart was said, you know what? From this day forward, there will never cease to be one of your descendants, ruling on the throne of my people. And even when your son Solomon, sins, I will not depart from him as I did from Saul, but I will chasten him as a father would chasten his son. And God is said to do this because of his honor for David. It wasn't because of anything Solomon had done. It wasn't because Solomon was necessarily a good or a bad person, though he started off to be a good person. But God's decision to do this for David was to honor David. And Obviously, the greatest number of people he did this with was long after David's death. But it didn't matter that David was dead. God still honored his friend, David. And now you and I both know that David was with the Lord on one level or another in paradise. But God continued to honor the relationship and the commitment, the holiness, if you will, that David had had in his life to the Lord by continuing to have someone that ruled on the throne that represented the family of David. So it's a characteristic of God. So here, David's doing something very similar in that he's honoring the son of his friend long after his friend's death. So now we're going to go ahead and read in 2 Samuel chapter 10. Yes, ma'am.
Hey, Mark,
yes.
Uh-huh. Could you explain something you just said that I think if I remember correctly, you said that David was on some level of paradise with God.
Yes, before Jesus died and rose again, nobody went to heaven when they died. Those that believed in the coming Messiah were kept in a place that the Bible calls paradise or Abraham's bosom. There's several different names for it, but it was just a place where the dead who had believed in a coming Messiah were held until righteousness by faith was made available through the death, resurrection of Jesus Christ. That's the reason why Jesus said to the thief on the cross, "This day you will be with me in paradise," not in heaven, but in paradise. Also, you'll see in one of the parables that Jesus gave, he talked about how the rich man and the lame beggar Lazarus. No, was it Lazarus? I can't remember. I think because it wasn't, I don't remember what it was. But anyway, the bottom line is there was the parable, there was a rich man and a beggar. And the beggar died and he went on into Abraham's bosom. But the rich man, whose table he was not allowed to really eat from, he died and he went to the place of the damned. And it says in Jesus's illustration, he said that, though the rich man, when he died, he cried across this big gulf that was between the righteous and the unrighteous out to Abraham and said, "Abraham, dip your finger in some water and come and cool my tongue because I'm tormented in these flames." And Abraham said, "You know, when you were alive, you had, you know, all those provisions and you were doing well and all this." He said, and now in this life, you are being tormented. And here was this man who lay daily at your gates and you did not minister to him. And now he is taken care of for an eternity. And he said, "Well, then send a prophet up. Let me rise up from the dead and warn my brother and my brothers that they not come to this awful place." And he said, "No," he said, "they have the prophets and they have the scriptures. Let them hear them." He said, "Because even if someone were to raise from the dead, they would not hear them." Well, I give you that illustration because even in this illustration Jesus was giving, it was clear that where the righteous who had died were was clearly not in heaven. It was in some region that we believe was under the earth. And there's a huge gap that was between the unrighteous dead and the righteous dead. That's where Lazarus went and where he rose from the dead when Jesus called for him. So it wasn't until Jesus died and preached to the saints in paradise that they were able to, along with Jesus, go to heaven. So that's what I mean by that. God was not necessarily in a manifest form in paradise, but in one fashion or another, God's spirit was present all places, but particularly in paradise. So when David passed away, that's what I meant. He was in some way or another with God in paradise. That's what I meant by that. He was.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
That's good.
Okay. Okay, now let's go to 2 Samuel chapter 10, starting in verse 1. It says, starting in verse 1, it says, "It happened after this that the king of all the people of Ammon died, and Hanun, his son, reigned in his place. Then David said, 'I will show kindness to Hanun, the son of Nahash, as his father showed kindness to me.' So David sent by the hand of his servants to comfort him concerning his father, and David's servants came to the into the land of the people of Ammon. Now, before we go any further, because this gets a little muddy as we go on, I don't want to have to circle back, so I'll just say it now. This is the second example of where David is showing kindness to someone, and he's doing it more for to honor the man who died than the son. There's no indication that David even knew this guy's son, other than maybe a casual acquaintance. But because he'd had a good relationship with this pagan king in the past, he wanted to show kindness to this this young man who had just lost his dad, who was the king. And so again, it's just another attestation to the character of David. And I want you to remember that when it came to do with Mephibosheth, the kindness he wanted to show, he said, I want to show God's kindness to him. And that's yet another little sub-lesson that's of primary importance, and that is that David, in his walk, in his time, in his encounters with the Lord, learned and came to know God as a kind God. You know, and that's a unique thing. If you remember, all of our travels through the Bible since Genesis, God has progressively revealed himself by different names. Most of them have something to do with provision or power or his lordship or something along that line. But David had a revelation of God as kind. And what a revelation that is. What a huge revelation that is. And so, in fact, David is later attributed as having said that God's gentleness or kindness has made me great. So David definitely heavily relied upon God's kindness and his goodness, even at a time when he was brought into severe judgment because he had done something he ought not have done. And God, in his honor of David, came to David and said, you know what, I'm going to give you three options, but you're going to have to be judged. And he gave him three different options, choose one of them. And David said to God, he said, you know what, you choose. Because I trust you, number one, and may I always fall into the hand of God. May I never fall into the hand of man. David said those words because he knew God to be a good and a kind God. So, you know, so with Mephibosheth and now with this man, Hunan, he wanted to show God's kindness in times of that were difficult. And you have to love David's heart in this. So that's where we are. Let's go ahead and pick up in verse 3. And the princes of all the people of Ammon said to Hanan. Yeah, I see her. hey, Vivian. The princes of all the people of Ammon said to Hanan, their lord, do you think that David really honors your father because he sent comforters to you? Has David not really rather sent his servants to you to search the city and to spy it out in order to overthrow it? So, I mean, people are going to see evil intent if their hearts are evil. You know, the Bible in the New Testament speaks to this on another level, and it says that to the wicked and perverse, all things are perverse, but to the righteous, all things are good. These people were wicked. And what they perceived was their own heart in David rather than David's heart. So picking up in verse 4, it says, therefore, Hanan took David's servants, shaved off half of their beards, cut their garments in the middle at their buttocks, and sent them away. When they told David, he sent to meet them because the men were greatly ashamed. And the king said, wait at Jericho until your beards have grown and then return. Now, that's a bit of a Jewish thing right there. They would allow their beards to grow, and it was part of their culture. To cut the beard, unless, of course, you had taken a Nazirite vow, was a shame. And they knew this. And so the king of Ammon cut it in half on purpose in order to shame them. Verse 6, it says, when the people of Ammon saw that they had made themselves repulsive to David, the people of Ammon sent and hired the Syrians of Beth Rahab and the Syrians of Zobah, 20,000 foot soldiers, and from the king of Maacah, 1,000 men, and from Ishtob, 12,000 men. Now when David heard of it, he sent Joab and all the army of the mighty men. Then the people of Ammon came out and put themselves in battle array at the entrance of the gate. And the Syrians of Rahab, and Ishtob and Maacah were by themselves in the field. When Joab saw that the battle line was against him both before and behind, in other words, he was surrounded, he chose some of the Israelites best and put them in battle array against the Syrians, and the rest of the people he put under the command of Abishai, his brother, that he might set them in battle array against the people of Ammon. Then he said, "If the Syrians are too strong for me, then you shall help me. But if the people of Ammon are too strong for you, then I'll come and help you. Be of good courage and let us be strong for our people and for the cities of our God. And may the Lord do what is good in his sight." And again, this is such a great example. Joab had been, had been a good man largely since he had been underneath David. And he had learned some lessons. I don't know if it was from David or just on his own. But, you know, you notice it kind of goes back in my mind to how we sometimes now pray for weather. Rather than try to control things and tell God what's right and what's wrong, you know, there are times because we don't know, like it says in Romans 8, what we should pray for, how to offer that prayer in a worthy manner as we must. We don't know. And so we just cry out to the Lord and say, you know what? Do what is the best, Lord. And that's Joab, obviously, and his brother had gone into battle with the intentions of winning. But the end of their statement was, may the Lord do what is good in his own sight. We're going to lay our life out there, but we do it for king and country, and we do it for our God, and let him do what he deems as right. And we sign our names as an agreement, whatever God decides. That right there is faith. That right there is genuine hupotasso underneath God and saying, you know what? I honor you, and whatever you say is good. So really, really great, great lesson there. And I mean, it's easy for you and I maybe to say that, you know, in the day-to-day life. It's quite another to do that when you're about to charge in the battle and you could die at the edge of a sword, literally in just a few moments. But so, I mean, these weren't just, you know, words spoken in haste. It wasn't Christianese. It was what was in his heart. He really meant this. Lord, do what is right in your sight. So picking up in verse 13, it says, "So Joab and the people who were with him drew near for the battle against the Syrians, and they fled before him. When the people of Ammon saw that the Syrians were fleeing, they also fled before Abishai and entered the city. So Joab returned from the people of Ammon and went to Jerusalem. When the Syrians saw that they had been defeated by Israel, they gathered together. Then Hadadezer sent and brought out the Syrians who were beyond the river, and they came to Helam and Sobach, the commander of Hadadezer's army, went before them. Verse 17. When it was told to David, he gathered all Israel, crossed over the Jordan, and he came to Helam. And the Syrians set themselves in battle array against David and fought with him. Then the Syrians fled before Israel, and David killed 700 charioteers and 40,000 horsemen of the Syrians and struck Sobach, the commander of the army, who died there. And when all the kings who were servants to Hadadezer saw that they were defeated by Israel, they made peace with Israel and served them. So the Syrians were afraid to help the people of Ammon anymore." Now we're going to read the counterpoint to this in 1 Chronicles. So go ahead and turn there. Chapter 19. 1 Chronicles chapter 19. Again, if you remember, Chronicles was written much, 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 much later in history. 2 Samuel was written not long after the facts took place. Chronicles was looking back on it by several hundred years. And there are some differences, not a lot. One big thing we often notice is their names changes. That's something that happens even today in natural history. So in 1 Chronicles chapter 19, starting in verse 1, says, "It happened after this that Nahash, the king of the people of Ammon, died, and his son reigned in his place. Then David said, I will show kindness to Hanan, the son of Nahash, because his father showed kindness to me. So David sent messengers to comfort him concerning his father. And David's servants came to Hanan in the land of the people of Ammon to comfort him. And the princes of the people of Ammon said to Hanan, "Do you think that David really honors your father because he has sent comforters to you? Did his servants not come to you to search out and to overthrow and to spy out the land?" Therefore Hanan took David's servants and shaved them and cut their garments in the middle at their buttocks and sent them away. Then some went and told David about the men, and he sent to meet them because the men were greatly ashamed. And the king said, "Wait at Jericho until your beards have grown and then return." I didn't mention this in the last one. We were already in 2 Samuel, but again, you see the provision of David. He sends people to meet them, obviously with extra clothes and with provisions so that they can hunker down and stay someplace until their beards have grown back, and then come back home not in shame. Again, it shows tender loving kindness. It shows provision. It shows empathy, someone who puts himself in their position and shows honor to them. Again, it's a kind of thing that in a world that is governed by God, you would expect. It's also the kind of thing in a fallen world, you just don't see that much. And David was just such a wonderful, wonderful guy. And I'm just grateful to, you know, even read about him and gratefully know him by way of scripture. Just tremendous man of God. So going on in verse 5 again, it says, "Then some went and told David about the men, and he sent to meet them because they were greatly ashamed. And the king said, 'Wait at Jericho until your beards have grown and then return.'" Verse 6, "When the people of Ammon saw that they had made themselves repulsive to David, Hanan and the people of Ammon sent 1,000 talents of silver to hire for themselves chariots and horsemen from Mesopotamia, from Syrian Mecca, and from Zobah. So they hired for themselves 32,000 chariots with the king of Mecca and his people, who came and encamped before Medeba. Also, the people of Ammon gathered together from their cities and came to battle." So already you can see, hopefully you remember, some of those names were different. But again, that really shouldn't be a shock because, like I said, Chronicles was written many, many years later. In order for the book to seem relevant to the people it was written to, more than likely they were using the names of the city that had that were contemporary in their time. The names had changed. And either because of conquest or whatever. And so to give a geographical location, they would call it by its current name, which would have changed over the years. So picking up in verse 8, it says, "Now when David heard of it, he sent Joab and all the army of the mighty men. Then the people of Ammon came out and put themselves in battle array before the gate of the city, and the kings who had come were by themselves in the field. When Joab saw that the battle line was against him before and behind, he chose some of Israel's best and put them in battle array against the Syrians. And the rest of the people he put under the command of Abishai, his brother, and they set themselves in battle array against the people of Ammon." Verse 12, "Then he said, 'If the Syrians are too strong for me, then you shall come and help me. But if the people of Ammon are too strong for you, then I'll help you. Be of good courage, and let us be strong for our people and for the cities of our God, and may the Lord do what is good in his sight.' So Joab and the people who were with him drew near for the battle against the Syrians, and they fled before him. When the people of Ammon saw that the Syrians were fleeing, they also fled from before Abishai his brother and entered the city. So Joab went to Jerusalem. Now, when the Syrians saw that they had been defeated by Israel, they sent messengers and brought the Syrians who were beyond the river, and Shaphak, the commander of Hadadezer's army, went before them." Verse 17. "When it was told David, he gathered all Israel, crossed over the Jordan, and came upon them and set up in battle array against them. So when David had set up in battle array against the Syrians, he fought with him. Then the Syrians fled from before Israel, and David killed 7,000 charioteers, 40,000 foot soldiers of the Syrians, and killed Shaphak, the commander of the army. And when the servants of Hadadezer saw that they were defeated by Israel, they made peace with David and became his servants. So the Syrians were not willing to help the people of Ammon anymore. Now, rather than sending you back to 2 Samuel, let's just pick up in 1 Chronicles chapter 20, starting in verse 1. We're reading through verse 3. Very short verses. We're literally almost done tonight because I didn't want to go further into dealing with David and Bathsheba because that opens up a whole brand new thing, and I would have had to end in the middle of it. So we are right now in 1 Chronicles chapter 20, starting in verse 1, and this is talking about the capture of Reba. Starting in verse 1, 1 Chronicles chapter 20, it says, "It happened in the spring of the year, at the time that kings go out to battle, that Joab led the army forces and ravaged the country of the people of Ammon and came and besieged Rabbah. Now, but David stayed at Jerusalem." Big mistake. "And Joab defeated Rabbah and overthrew it. Then David took their king's crown from his head and found it to weigh a talent of gold." Now that's not light. That's a lot. That's a decent amount of weight there. "And there were precious stones in it, and it was set on David's head. Also, he brought out the spoil of the city in great abundance. And he brought out the people who were in it and put them to work with saws and iron picks and axes. So David did to all the cities of the people of Ammon. Then David and all the people returned to Jerusalem." Now we're going to read the same account. If you go now to 2 Samuel chapter 11, we're just going to read verse 1. And even though it seems weird, then we're going to skip to chapter 12, verse 26. I'll tell you that when we get there. But right now we're looking at 2 Samuel chapter 11, just verse 1. 2 Samuel chapter 11, just verse 1. It says, "It happened in the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the people of Ammon and besieged Rabbah, but David remained at Jerusalem." Now we go into 2 Samuel chapter 12, just one chapter further, skipping down to verse 26, and we're just reading to verse 31, 26 through 31. 2 Samuel 12, 26 through 31. It says, "Now Joab fought against Rabbah and the people of Ammon and took the royal city. And Joab sent messengers to David and said, 'I have fought against Rabbah and have taken the city's water supply. Now, therefore, gather the rest of the people together and camp against the city and take it, lest I take the city and it be called after my name.' So David gathered all the people together and went to Rabbah, fought against it, and took it. Then he took their king's crown from his head. It weighed, its weight was a talent of gold with precious stones, and it was set on David's head, and he brought out the spoils of the city in great abundance, and he brought out the people who were in it and put them to work with the saws and iron picks and iron axes and made them cross over to the brick works. So he did to all the cities of the people of Ammon. Then David and all the people returned to Jerusalem." We'll just go ahead and just throw this out here where we're ending, that I think that Joab had an understanding of what was really going on, like what we're going to be reading about next week with Bathsheba. One thing is almost certain. He probably was already a little torqued at David because of the fact that kings were supposed to go to war with their men. And this time, David chose not to. And so it kind of shows up in what he said to David. But in the same way, Joab was actually honoring David as well by telling him, "You know what? Respectfully, king, get off your you-know-what and get out here and finish taking the city, or else this city's going to be named after me instead of you." And so David got off his what's it and went out there and finished the job, and it was named after him. But if Joab had not done this, then, it would have been named after Joab. And David, the honor would have departed from David, and it would have been David's due for the honor to leave him. But he had good people who served him, and not without reason, because, again, by and large, we know David was a sinner just like everybody else, and he wasn't a perfect man, and he did some terrible things. But by and large, he was a good man. He loved the Lord. He wanted to honor him. He wanted to honor God's people. And he honored those people who were under his command. He was not a high-minded individual. This staying at home bit was out of character for David. And I mean, I might be reading the passage because, you know, I'm not alive 3,500 years ago. I have no idea what was actually going on in Joab's mind. And this wasn't even in Joab's hand that it was recorded. But I pick it up in the words that Joab was a little torqued at David because he wasn't where he belonged. But I also love the fact that people, based on the way I read these things, people still found David to be approachable, you know, and you know, again, that really says a lot. In David's day, it didn't matter really what kingdom you were from. It didn't matter if you were from Israel or from some other nation. You just don't approach a king. And when you do, you don't just approach him any old way. That's where, remember that verse we brought up a couple weeks ago that we, in the past, in our Word of Faith days, took out of context, made it say something it doesn't say, where it says, you know, a man's gift makes room for him. We used to take that as meaning that a person's spiritual gift would make room for their spiritual gift, which doesn't mean at all. It just literally means that if you're going to appear before a king, which was the context of the statement, bring a gift with you, and it'll pacify the king and give you audience with the king. But if you weren't granted audience, you just didn't go before a king back then. If you tried, they could take your head off. But David was an approachable man. And so again, I know it might sound like I'm overstating it, but you just can't say enough good things about this man, David. Even in the middle of things he was doing wrong, he still had some honor to him. So we're going to end with that. I will open the door for anybody to make any comments or questions or anything like that. But again, the reason why I made them praise and worship longer tonight, because I knew we had time for it. And I knew we were going to end pretty quickly because I didn't want to get into something that I'd have to cut off in the middle of that. So this allowed us to put a period where it belonged. So any thoughts or questions?
Was there anything that gave any indication as to why David stayed behind? We know later what he did, but...
No, as far as I know, unless it comes up much later in another book, which it might, and it just doesn't come to my mind at the moment, I don't think there is a stated reason as to why he did it. He certainly didn't do it with the intention of doing what he wound up doing.
No.
That's pretty clear. But in all honesty, I think he was just kind of sitting back on his laurels because he'd enjoyed an awful lot of victory and he probably just wasn't in the mood to go. I mean, but my opinion is certainly in every respect, not any better than anybody else's. Anyone here could give me another reason why, and I might just readily accept their proposal as well. Based on what I know, it was just a matter of, it's just a personal choice. He just didn't feel like going. All right. Well, if there's nothing else, we'll go ahead and close in prayer.
Grace. 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 Grace.